From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. You pick a movie, you order it, and a little red envelope arrives in the mail. That was how Netflix revolutionized entertainment. Before streaming and before binge watching was a thing, the idea that people might ditch the communal experience of going to the video store and instead prefer to wait for a DVD, yeah, you remember those? A DVD in the mail. It seems so obvious now, but back when Netflix co-founders first batted around the idea, they were told over and over again, that will never work. Well, this hour on Point, Netflix co-founder Mark Randolph joins us and shares the origin story of the company that changed the way we watch just about everything. And you can join us. What do you want to know about what it took to get Netflix off the ground and turn it into the company that we know it now, that $125 billion company that's one of the biggest in the world? What do you want to know about how Randolph brainstormed ideas for his next big thing? And are you one of those folks that still misses going to the video store or the movie store to pick something out to watch? Join us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Mark Randolph joins us today from New York. He is the co-founder of Netflix, and he's written its origin stories in a new book called That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. Mark Randolph, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
It's really great to have you. I first of all want to ask, I was tickled throughout the first part of the book when shampoo came up over and over again. What was it about shampoo that you thought might have made for a great thing to sell people back in 1997 before you hit upon the idea of movies?
Well, you know, back then when I was basically going to be out of a job and just figuring out what was the next company I wanted to start, I had all kinds of crazy ideas, and I really only had a single filter. I wanted it to be selling something on the internet, and I wanted it to involve personalization. I mean, those were themes that had been with me for a long time, and so I was looking for all kinds of crazy stuff. And when, you know, Reed Hastings and I were carpooling back and forth to work, we were brainstorming all kinds of ideas that involved selling things on the internet. And one of them was, wouldn't it be a great idea to do customized shampoo? People would send in a lot. No, bear with me here. This is an awesome idea. People would cut off a piece of their hair and they'd mail it to us and we'd formulate it for them. And then they could subscribe to that.
Wow. Okay.
You don't like that one? All right. Here's another one for you. Personalized, customized dog food for your pet. These were the types of ideas.
I think there are companies that are doing that now. You were ahead of your time on that one. You also had personalized baseball bats, surfboards I liked as well.
Yeah.
So those early carpools with you and Reed Hastings swapping cars between your rundown Volvo, as you call it, and Hastings, what, pristine Toyota? Is that it?
His gold Avalon.
I want to talk to you more about, like, I want you to put us in the car here for just a second. But let's take a step even further back. For people who don't know, okay, first of all, Reed Hastings is still currently the CEO of Netflix. But how did you and Hastings first meet?
So that story goes back, gosh, well more than 20 years ago. And two friends and I had started this small software company. And 9 months in, our company was acquired by a bigger company, which happened to have been founded and being run by Reed. And we all went to work for this big new company. And luckily, Reed and I lived in the same town and began carpooling to work every day. And this went on for 6 months or so, and then lightning struck a second time, and Reed's company was being acquired. But this time, the outcome was slightly different in that Reed and I were both going to lose our jobs in this merger. And I said, this is great. I'm just going to use this next few months while the deal's going through to figure out what my next company is going to be. And Reed, at the time, wanted to really try and change the world of education, so he was going to go back to school, get a higher degree in education. But, you know, once you're an entrepreneur, you're always an entrepreneur. Mm. So Reed wanted to keep a hand in, so we came to this agreement. We'd come up with an idea for a company, that he would be the angel investor, that I would start and run the company, and away we'd go. And that just begged the question, well, what will this new company be? And that led to months of us carpooling back and forth to work, brainstorming ideas. And I'd, at the end of the carpool, go into the office and spend the day researching it. End of the day, get back. And on the way home, I would tell Reed everything I discovered. And, you know, one of those crazy ideas was let's do video rental by mail.
Mm-hmm.
Big market, you know, potential. We had an entrenched competitor who left a customer experience that was suboptimal. Let's just put it that way. But, you know, back then, this was in 1997. You may remember that back then video rental was on VHS cassette.
Yeah.
You know, they're big and they're heavy and they're fragile and they're expensive. And so it didn't take a lot of research to realize that this idea was going to get tossed out the window in the same place the shampoo and the dog food ended up.
But hang on here for a second.
Yeah.
Because you're
okay.
Jumping ahead. It's the sort of thinking and brainstorming that, as you said, came before the hitting upon the idea of video rental that I want to explore with you a little bit
sure.
more. Because some folks might know there is that apocryphal story that, like, you know, Reed Hastings said, I don't want to have to spend $40 on a late fee for my Apollo 13 movie, so let's revolutionize that. But there was a lot of other things that went into that brainstorming beforehand. So put us in the carpool. Like, you and Hastings would get in the car, drive on a California highway. I mean, what was it like batting ideas back and forth?
Well, let's try and set the stage. So, I mean, first of all, Reed and I were opposites. We had very different personalities. You know, Reed has spent his entire career. He was a computer scientist. He was a mathematician. He was very logically driven and brilliant guy. And I had spent my entire life as a marketing person. So I was very much an extrovert. I was very empathetic. In fact, I prided myself on something I called remote empathy, the ability to know how someone would perceive something, even if I'm not looking at them. And it turned out that the two of us meshed almost perfectly, that with together those skills and experiences created a whole. And so Reed and I could have these incredibly spirited, I'll call them arguments, but we'd go back and forth with the logic of something, and would this work, and would customers actually go for that, and how much would they pay for it? And it was great because I'm a dreamer, and Reed in many ways is a realist.
Yeah.
And these car rides would be great because by the end of it, we'd have really wrung an idea dry, and we'd know by the end of that car ride whether it was even worth researching or not. And the other thing about Reed and I, and this is probably the luckiest thing and perhaps something that's actually carried through into Netflix, is that both of us were brutally honest with each other. For some reason, we never were people to shade the truth. We were never someone to try and be overly polite to spare someone's feelings. We both would just say exactly what we were thinking. And as anyone who's had that kind of relationship knows, it's so refreshing. And you can move so much faster when you know that when someone says something, that they
right.
truly mean it.
Well, so about your personalized dog food idea, right? I mean, Reed Hastings said, well, what happens if the dog dies? Right? I mean, he just sort of delivered it to you straight.
Yeah. Obviously, another way to put that, of course, is there's product liability concerns here, Mark. And, you know, of course, he's right. And then I could argue, yes, of course, but what are the odds of that happening? Is it worth taking the risk? But then you get down to things about how would you find customers and how long would someone continue to be a customer? I mean, it was really taking these ideas and stripping them down to their essence. But, you know, the fundamental thing we learned is it's impossible to know if an idea is a good idea or a bad idea just by talking about it,
right.
just by thinking about it, that at some point you've got to collide that idea with reality.
Interesting. So there's this – the mixture of forces in the founding of Netflix that I came away with in the book is, like you said, this willingness to think through and be rigorous brainstormers, to be honest with your co-founder. There's a lot of hard work. There's talent. And there's a lot of luck at play too. I mean, as you said, you first kind of, when you said maybe we should do this video rental business, the idea of doing VHS tapes was just kind of out from the beginning because they're too big, too bulky, too expensive to put in the mail. And the first bit I think of major luck you had is right around that time, DVDs got introduced in the United States. Like, what a stroke of luck.
Yeah, it was absolutely this right thing at the right time. And you're absolutely right. There was luck on a whole bunch of elements. I mean, the first thing, of course, was that DVD was in test market to begin with. And, you know, in many ways, it was this feeling akin to when you're cleaning up your living room and you find the jigsaw puzzle piece underneath the couch. And you go, what's this? And you pull it out and you realize it is the missing piece to that puzzle you've been working on for months that is still in a half-completed form on your kitchen table. And this was the piece. We had this video rental by mail, and all of a sudden in our lap was this medium which was thin and light and was actually going to be priced to sell. It solved all those problems. And so Reed and I puzzled over this and said, you know, wow, I wonder if we could use the U.S. mail. And then being the classic entrepreneurs, rather than going on to the office and working on a business plan or working on a pitch deck, we said, let's find out. And we turned the car around in mid-commute and drove back down to Santa Cruz where we lived. And you couldn't buy a DVD back then. So we settled for buying a music CD. We figured that would be a good enough proxy. And we bought a used music CD. Then went a few doors down and bought a little gift envelope like you'd put a greeting card in, and put the CD in the envelope, addressed it to Reed's house in Santa Cruz, and bought a stamp and dropped it in the slot at the Santa Cruz post office. And this is where lucky break number two comes in. Because
well, actually, Mark, I'm going to have you hold on here because we have to take a break in about 30 seconds. So this is my teaser for folks.
It's the cliffhanger.
Yeah, stick with us over the break here so you can hear what lucky break number two was in the earliest days of the founding of Netflix. Mark Randolph joins us. He is the co-founder of Netflix. He left the company in 2002, but he's walking us through the story of how this company that has changed the way how we consume media was first created. It's a story told in his new book, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mark Randolph. He is the co-founder of Netflix, and he tells the origin stories of the company in the new book, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. We've got an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Now, Mark, before the break, you were telling us this is such a terrific story about how you're like, huh, can we actually send a DVD in the mail? And so you got a CD, you stuck it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and then what happened?
Where we'd last left our protagonists, we had just dropped the movie in the slot. And, you know, I don't know whether you've actually been to a post office in the last 15 or 20 years, but they have two slots. They have one called local mail and one called out of town. And the reason for that is they have two totally different mail streams. The local mail just goes in the slot and goes directly into the carrier route and it gets put in the post office box. The other one goes to a central facility where it's put into machines that look like they're out of a science fiction James Bond torture device and shot at high speeds and high pressure. But ours took the gentle route. And so that very next morning when Reed came to pick me up at the house for the carpool, he held up this unbroken CD that had gotten to his house in less than a day for the price of a stamp. And we went, oh my gosh, this might work. Yeah. But it was what they say in the testing business is a false positive. Because if Reed had lived in some other town, if it had gone into the out-of-town slot, likely that the way we mailed it, it would have gotten broken into 100 pieces. And rather than holding up the unbroken CD, Reed would have poured a whole pile of little plastic bits into my hand. And we'd probably be talking about dog food right now.
Or shampoo.
Okay. Or shampoo.
I mean, did you have a lot of those sort of unknowing fork in the road moments in the year before Netflix actually launched in 98?
You know, a startup, people think these things spring fully formed, but there's 100 forks in the road. And, you know, some of them come from you having some experience in guessing what's the right fork, and some of them are dumb luck. I mean, even the DVD, we were betting that this technology would actually take off, but it might have gone the way of the Laserdisc. Mm-hmm. You know, haven't heard of the Laserdisc? Well, there you go. Instead, the DVD actually did work, and that helped us get a foothold. But for the first year and a half, the idea, DVDs by mail, was crazy. When everyone said that will never work, they were right. No one wanted to do it. We had due dates. We had late fees. It's no surprise we could hardly get anybody to rent from us for those first little bits.
Right, because exactly the things that people loathed about going to the video store, you were kind of recreating to a certain degree through an online service. But the company did go through – like those early ideas, you adjusted them really quickly. But there's another thing that I found so revealing before your launch date in 98, and that is when – you, in terms of the people telling you that will never work, you visit a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and forgive me, his name's escaping me now, one of the many Frenchmen that feature in
your my
story.
Life, right?
And he tells you, your idea is terrible. And why? Because you're focusing on DVDs. And even back in 1997, he's like, this is going to be a very short-lived technology. Why would I invest in something that's not going to be on the scene for more than a couple of years? Can you tell us about that moment?
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly a prominent one. And it was unusual because usually when you go to an investor, they have no incentive to say no. They figure out some way to say maybe. And so the fact that he was saying no was pretty revealing. But everyone had one of two objections. One was, of course, why is this going to work when there's 9,000 Blockbuster stores? But the other one was what you pointed out, which is that this is a digital medium. It's just a matter of weeks, people would say, before everyone's downloading it or streaming it. And you know, we knew that he was right, that eventually people would download or stream entertainment. What we differed was how long that would take. And our guess was this was not going to be immediate. I mean, partly there was the bandwidth issue because no one had fast internet connections back then. But when they did, it connected to their computer in their office, not to their television in their living room. But we knew from day one that we had to build a company which could work in this world of mailing DVDs to people, but yet we had to be ready. We had to build the company around something which actually would have value when the ground shifted underneath us and all of a sudden people did begin wanting to download or stream. And you realize I'm saying download or stream because quite frankly, back at the time, Reed and I had no idea which it was going to be.
Right. Well, and what about that first bit of pushback that you frequently got, that like, why would anybody do this? I can walk to a Blockbuster virtually anywhere or drive quickly anywhere in the United States.
Well, there's two things that we had going for us that in our dumb optimism. One, of course, is that Blockbuster actually had as a core tenet of its business model something they internally called managed dissatisfaction. And I can tell you, you always want to go up against a competitor who has a key part of their business plan, something called managed dissatisfaction. But the other thing was the dynamics of the DVD. The reality is there were so few DVD players that the odds of any individual Blockbuster store having more than one or two of them in the neighborhood was very remote, meaning it would be a long, long time before the average Blockbuster stocked DVDs. And we said, if we can get a jump, if we can be the place in the world where people can come to and find every DVD available, maybe we can get some critical mass before they decide to enter.
Okay. So you wanted to be sort of a first to market on this new format then.
Exactly.
But how did you recruit folks? I mean, this is one of those things that I think anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur, wants to get into the startup world wonders. Like, how do you recruit folks when you have such a nascent idea that most people's first reaction is, that'll never work?
You mean employees?
Employees,
or partners?
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a certain breed of people who thrives on uncertainty, who loves coming into the room and solving really fun problems with other smart people. And one of the big advantages of, at the time, being in Silicon Valley, now of course it happens every place, was having lots of like-minded souls. And I was 38 when I started Netflix. I'd had a track record of starting other companies and working with other people, and I'd accumulated my little band of favorites. And in some ways, this was, let's get the band back together again. But there is this element of persuasion. But you can't fake it. You have to make people believers, and the most solid way you can do that is by demonstrating you believe it yourself. I mean, there was one time that I was pitching someone to join, and I was telling them, you know, this is your stock options. One of these days, you know, this stock's going to be worth $100 a share or something, some crazy promise. And someone afterwards said, God, Mark, don't you feel funny, you know, BSing that person? And it really took me back because I wasn't BSing the person. I genuinely believe that myself.
You lowballed what the Netflix stock was going to be worth someday, I think.
Yeah, I guess I was BSing them. It was worth a lot more.
There's another wonderful little charming story you tell about how you had to raise a little bit of money, that seed money to begin with. Now, Reed Hastings gave you most of it, so he's your co-founder and majority investor from the start. But you got some money from some other folks, including your mom. And I just wanted you to tell that story because it's wonderful. Why were you nervous when you had to ask your mom if she could be a seed investor for you?
You know, they call it the friends and family round for a reason. And it's largely because, at least back in 1997, these ideas are so out there that the only person who's going to back you is the true believer. And sometimes that's just your friends and your family. And Reed did put in the majority of the money, but we wanted outside validation. We wanted money from somebody else, at least to demonstrate that Reed and I weren't in an echo chamber. And one of them was my mom. And it was funny because in some ways it was this kabuki theater, this ritualized performance, because I knew that she probably would invest. And I think she knew that she was going to say yes when I asked, but we still had to go through the act. And in many ways, it felt like I was, you know, 6 years old at the swimming pool, pulling on her sleeve, asking for 5 cents so I could buy French fries at the snack bar. You know, please, Mom, can I have $25,000 to invest in my company? And, you know, I think when she said yes, I think she genuinely believed she was never going to see that money again.
Well, it's a good thing that she said yes, I'd say. Good on you, Mom. But there's something I keep coming back to, Mark, and that is we're having this conversation in 2019 where so many aspects of what technology is today, you know, streaming, the fact that virtually anybody and their kid can start a website in a matter of minutes. These are things we take for granted now. But in 1997, none of that existed. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about what it was like or the challenges that you faced in, you know, that sort of compressed 6 months before the launch of Netflix. What are the kinds of things you had to build from the ground up?
You know, you frame it pretty well, is that right now it's relatively trivial to take an idea and figure out quickly if it's a good idea or a bad idea. After we'd kind of did that initial test to see whether you could actually mail a DVD, to find out if it would actually work, if customers would actually come, was a really hard challenge because there was none of the infrastructure. There was no cloud. You couldn't download. You couldn't get an instance of Squarespace. If you wanted to do analytics, you couldn't get Optimizely. If you wanted to take payments, you couldn't do Stripe or PayPal. All these things, if you wanted them, you had to build them yourself. We had to write the code for a web server. We had to install our own servers and our own racks and wire them ourselves. Had to figure out how to do analytics, how to capture payments by negotiating things with the bank. I mean, the things that someone could do now in an hour took us 6 months, you know, and nearly $1 million just to build this simple functioning e-commerce website. And you may hear my voice, but functioning is in italics because, wow, it was marginally functioning.
The website, the mailer, that the DVDs were going to go out. Sourcing the DVDs themselves, you write about, was quite an adventure. It was like every little aspect of the company, you were kind of, I don't want to say making it up, but building it as you went along.
Making it up is a great word for it. I mean, there certainly is no one you can ask, what's going to happen when we do a website which does DVD by mail? What will it take to accumulate every single DVD available, all 970 of them? What will it take to find content for these? I mean, each of these was an adventure. I mean, even going and trying to convince – we tried to convince the big consumer electronics companies to put coupons into their box. And wow, was that an alien environment.
Yeah.
That was me flying from California to the wilds of suburban New Jersey to these huge office parks and these massive Sony and Panasonic buildings. And it was like going to a different world and trying to convince these staid, big corporate companies to take this winger on this little website that was brand new. Hmm. I mean, there's a challenge for you.
You know, Mark, you sound in this conversation very much like the man that I read in the book. You sound relentlessly or compulsively optimistic. There must have been a day before the launch of Netflix where maybe you thought this isn't going to work, that all those people who said that'll never work, maybe they're right.
I guess you're right. I am an optimist because there's setbacks, but I never believed we wouldn't be able to figure it out. You know, I never really was holding on tight to any individual idea, but I was pretty locked into this problem that there had to be a way to make DVD rental by mail work. And even when things looked really dark, we pushed through. But, you know, the great thing is in those months leading up to the launch in April of 1998, there's no external counter validation. There's no one in your mind, you're going, this is going to be incredible. The reality only hits when customers vote. That sobers you up really quickly.
Okay, so what happened in April of 1998 then, when the website officially launched?
You know, you know the anticipation here. We had spent 6 months building this thing piece by piece, and that morning we were all gathered in my conference room waiting to see what would happen. And in this stroke of genius, I might say, we had rigged up the computer that a bell would ring every time an order came in. And the other side of the conference room, we had a big bucket with champagne bottles because we were going to toast all of our hard work. And at 8 o'clock, we hit some keys and we were live. And we all stood around expectantly waiting. And luckily, it didn't take long. And all of a sudden, the ding, that first order. And we all cheered. And then ding, 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 like three more. And we were pouring the champagne. And then ding, 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 we had 7 orders. And then we were still clapping each other on the back. And then realized it's been a while since that bell rang. And was it plugged in? We had like crashed both of our servers in the first 15 minutes of being in business. So rather, this memory of the first day was not like toasting success with champagne. The memory is pushing the shopping cart at the consumer electronics store where our CTO piled in all the components to limp our servers along for that long first day. And it was sobering, but we got through. And I think we ended the first day with 137 orders, which was amazing, amazing. I had no idea. Okay. That was the first of many astounding moments.
All right. So overall then, an exciting first day. But in the following months though, if I remember correctly, customer appeal, I mean, you didn't get as many customers as you wanted because it turned out that like waiting a couple of days for a DVD in the mail like just didn't – it didn't bring in the hordes immediately.
All the people who said that will never work, well, they were starting to look like they were right because people weren't renting from us. And if they rented once, they weren't renting a second time. And kind of even worse, people were buying DVDs because surprise, surprise, we also sold DVDs. And by the end of the first month, 98-something% of our revenue was coming from selling DVDs. And that was bad because we knew that was a non-renting sustainable business, that eventually Amazon back then only sold books, if you can believe it, and they were eventually going to start selling DVDs too, and then we'd be toast. So we had to figure it out, and we decided to focus all in on rental.
Well, Mark Randolph, hang in here for just a second. Mark Randolph is the co-founder of Netflix. He tells the story of the company's earliest days in the new book, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mark Randolph. He is the co-founder of Netflix, and he tells the story of the company's earliest days in the new book, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. And Mark, I just want to just take a moment here to play an ad from early in Netflix life. I think this is in the early 2000 roughly. And you're going to hear a busy mom in the ad explaining why she likes renting DVDs from Netflix.
Going to the video store is a hassle. With Netflix, just make a list of the movies you want to see. And in about one business day, you'll get three delivered to your house. Keep them as long as you want, without late fees. Finish one, return it in this prepaid envelope, and they'll send you another movie from your list.
Can you get that?
Mommy's doing a TV commercial!
Netflix. All the movies you want, $22 a month, and no late fees.
It's an early Netflix ad. And Mark, I have to tell you, going after the exhausted mom demographic, I'm right there with you. I can see why you did that. But $22 a month now, actually, to my ears, sounds like quite a lot. But what was the thing that made Netflix, after its launch in 1998, think, oh, man, we should come up with a different way of doing this, that like individual rentals aren't going to cut it?
You know, desperation has a great way of stimulating the imagination. And this was a year and a half of not being able to figure out how to make this work. And we were kind of down to scraping the bottom here. But one of the things we recognized is we had this warehouse which had hundreds of thousands of DVDs sitting in it. And, you know, Reed and I were in the warehouse one day chatting and saying, it's kind of funny. Why are all these DVDs sitting here where they're of no use to anybody? I wonder if we could figure out a way to store them at the customers' houses. Let them just keep them as long as they want. And why charge them when they swap them? Let's just do a subscription. And it was another crazy idea, like the dog food and like the shampoo. But unlike them, this one worked. When we tested it, it was amazing. Almost instantaneously, it resonated with people. And we kind of realized one of the things it did was take our disadvantage and instantly make it our advantage. Because the problem before was, compared to Blockbuster, you had to wait. But now when you can keep the DVDs as long as you want, when you wanted a movie, it was instantaneous. It was sitting on top of your television. And so it was even faster than driving to Blockbuster. And that is what turned the corner for us. That was the moment, in many ways, that we stopped being a startup and kind of became a real company.
Okay. I just want to step back in time here a little bit, because there is just a little side story that I should have asked you earlier, because it was just so charming to read about how Netflix, which is now literally a household name in many, many countries, how did you guys come up with that name? Because you had some alternatives, which They're not as catchy as Netflix. You want to just tell us that story?
You know, coming up with a name for a company is more challenging than you might imagine because you have to have a lot of criteria for a name. You know, it has to be able to get a domain name for it, of course. It also has to be trademarkable. It can't be similar to someone else's name. It can't mean something obscene in some different language. And, you know, one of the advice people give you is when you have your initial name, the name you're using as your what's called a beta name, the name you before you have your real name, they said make that name so bad that when you get struggling with your real name, you won't be tempted to use your beta name. And our beta name was kibble.com, like the dog food. No similarity there. And of course, when we got to that point, it was tough. And in fact, we had this list of 10 finalists. And they were weird names. One was like Take Two. One was Replay. One was Cinema Center. And then there was Netflix. And quite frankly, a lot of people didn't like it because back in the late 90s, the euphemism for a pornographic film was a skin flick. So skin flicks. And then, of course, there was that big X at the end of Netflix. But, you know, desperation does strange things. And so that ended up being the best of a lot of choices. And so even though it sounded a little porny, Netflix it was.
You heard it here at On Point. Mark, stand by for just a second because I want to just let in a caller here. Susanna is calling from Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Susanna, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just was calling to comment that in 99, my husband and I moved from the Bay Area to New Mexico onto the Navajo Indian Reservation. And where we live, which was right in the reservation, there was a little teeny video store, but the selection was dismal. It was basically really ancient movies or B-movies. And my husband had heard about Netflix, and I feel like we were one of your first subscribers, and I just wanted to say that it was a life changer for us for the 3 years you were on the reservation.
Well, thank you, Susanna, and thanks for, in your some small way, helping put my kids through school. So we both got something out of this relationship.
Susanna, thank you for your call. Okay, so back to this the big idea you had about putting people on subscription, like Susanna there. Pretty quickly, you got a couple of 100,000 subscribers. But the company was, I mean, Mark, forgive me, like, I'm just going to have to pull you away from your standpoint of ruthless optimism and down into reality, because Netflix was still losing money even as you brought in a lot of subscribers. And so talk to me about those months and years before the company went public. It was not smooth sailing.
No, we were, as I describe it, drowning in our own success. And you heard in the commercial you played how she had to articulate what was this crazy thing? No due dates, no late fees, subscription? And it was so complicated that the way to get around that was to give our subscribers their first month free. But when you do that, you take all the cost up front and then make it back little bit over many months. Which means when you have runaway success, you have runaway expense. And so customers were flooding in. And on one hand, I was going, this is awesome. And on the other hand, I was wringing my hands going, oh my God, we're going to go broke. And just to add insult to injury, this came to a head in the fall of the year 2000, which was the very moment that the final bits of air were streaming out of that dot-com balloon. So there was no money to be had, and we were losing money hand over fist, but we had finally solved the problem. It felt so ironic to have been so close, but yet to run out of money and have to close down.
Mm. There was a hope that you would have a deal with Amazon. That did not happen, as you mentioned. A bid that Blockbuster would buy Netflix?
Well, that was going to be our savior. We felt we are desperate. And so when you're desperate, you do this thing called pursue strategic alternatives, which, of course, is just code for we have got to sell this sucker fast. And the obvious strategic alternative at the time was Blockbuster. But they were huge and we were tiny. And so when we called them to try and get the meeting or we wrote to them or used go-betweens, nothing. you know, not a peep. Until finally, about 2 months later, they called us and said, we'll meet with you. And they met what they called, and we were on retreat. So I had no fancy clothes with me. I was in shorts. And we flew to Dallas for this meeting and ended up in this huge conference room. And they're there in their suits, and I'm there in my shorts and a T-shirt. And I remember I was kind of jealous because Reed was there in a Hawaiian shirt. You know, he had buttons on. But we pitched selling the company, that we would combine forces and they'd do the stores, we'd do the online. But then when they asked how much should we pay for you, we came up with a number based on how much money we were losing and said $50 million. And they laughed at us, or almost. And that was sobering because we had thought this was going to be the deus ex machina that saved us. But now we realized that the only way out was through. There was no escape. There was no magic solution that we would have to take Blockbuster on head on.
And I mean, you did, right? Because who am I talking to today, right? I'm talking to the co-founder of Netflix, and Blockbuster is gone. I mean, yes, on the one hand, that is absolutely a mark of this company's monstrous success. But I do wonder, how do you feel being the co-founder of an idea that led to the end of a whole business model, a brand name company, jobs for all those people who used to work at those Blockbusters? I mean,
well,
how do you
now
feel?
Now you're gonna bum me out. I mean, because quite frankly, I feel badly. I mean, this was Blockbuster employed 60,000 people, and that's not a legacy that I want. That's awful, but it's not something that is one person's responsibility. It's certainly not even one company's responsibility. It's changing times. And although I'm depressed about that, I'm extremely excited and optimistic about what Netflix has created, for all the jobs that they've created, not just at Netflix, but in Hollywood, in content creation, in all the other areas where changing the way people watch entertainment is creating opportunities for all kinds of people. So that's the nature of disruption, is that when one thing goes, something else, hopefully better, replaces it.
Well, I mean, we don't have enough time for me to nitpick at that a little bit, Mark, because it's not necessarily the same people who are getting the jobs in the new economy that Netflix is being one of the companies that the new economy – sorry, that Netflix was a major force in ushering us into. But that's for another day. You come back in a couple of months and we'll have that discussion. I do want to ask you about – when you were demoted at Netflix, because it's a really great story about that long-running partnership and friendship with Reed Hastings and how that came to a head in, what was it, 2002, 2000?
Earlier than that, actually. I mean, and Reed at the time was not working full-time at the company. He was my biggest investor. He was chairman of the board. But one evening, as I was working late, he poked his head in and kind of delivered those words we've all heard at one point or another, which is, you know, Mark, we've got to talk. And nothing good usually comes of that. But Reed came in and he was concerned, and more specifically concerned about my leadership, about judgment, about what was going to happen as the company had to move more quickly, as it got larger, as the problems became more complex. And as I sat there having him tell me these things, at first I thought, is he firing me? You know, he is the largest shareholder. He has control of the company that way. But I realized eventually that's not what he was saying. That what he was saying was, if we really want Netflix to succeed, it will do better if we run this company together. That he come in as CEO, I would slide over as president, and we would go on that way. And it was a shocking moment in a way, because I had had this dream of starting and running this successful company, but I realized now I kind of had to decide which dream was more important, the one about me running the company or the idea about it being more successful. And ultimately, I realized that the dream of being successful wasn't just mine. It was shared now by those employees I'd been convinced to join, by the investors who'd put their money into the company. And it wasn't the kind of decision I could come to instantaneously, but over the next day or two, I decided that Reed was right. The company would be stronger. And I did make room and he did join as CEO. And in many ways, that was the beginning of a renaissance at Netflix. That's when we solved the problem of the business model. That's where all the progress on personalization came from. And then certainly if you look at what Reed has done for the company since I left in 2003, looking back, that has to be one of the smartest decisions that I ever made.
Interesting. Well, Netflix went public in 2002. As you say, you left in 2003. There are 150 plus million subscribers now. It is one of the biggest, most important companies in Silicon Valley alongside Facebook, Apple, Amazon, and Google, right? Those companies are all lumped together. I mean, just yesterday, we were having a conversation with Rana Faruhar of the Financial Times, who's written this new book about how she says Silicon Valley has lost its soul and these major companies sort of lost their founding principles. And she groups Netflix among them. As you've watched this company that you created from the beginning, what do you think of that? Do you think Netflix has retained its soul as it's become this giant behemoth?
So I no longer work at Netflix, so I can't necessarily comment on their current strategies and tactics, but I can comment on their culture. Because I know the culture, and I know that culture is intact. And I know from the very first instant we started that company, it was all about what is right for the customer. And that now, I do know, permeates every meeting, every conversation, every decision. Fundamentally, I truly believe that Netflix is all about what is best for the customer. It is not about shareholders. It is not about partners. It is not about employees. And
come
I think
on,
as long
Mark.
As,
come on. Really? Come on.
Hey, I'm an optimist. I believe these things. And I really do. I mean, listen, that is what makes culture. It's how you behave. It's how you treat each other. And I'm not there every day, but I saw it consistently for the full time I was there. And every contact I've had since convinces me it is still the truth.
So That Will Never Work is the title of the book. Obviously, it did. So it makes me want to know, what are you at work now that is supposed to not work in the future? What's next for Mark Randolph at the moment?
When you tell me that'll never work, it is like red flag in front of a bull. You know, I left Netflix in 2003 because it was no longer a startup. And, you know, my definition of success is getting to do what you love and what you're good at. And working with startups is what I love and what I'm good at. And now I get a chance to mentor other early stage entrepreneurs. And I get the same thing I had at Netflix of sitting in a room with really smart people solving really interesting problems. But now I get to go home at 5 o'clock. And let them stay up all night solving those problems.
Well, Mark Randolph is the co-founder of Netflix. He's author of the new book, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Mark, it's been a real great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
It's been a pleasure as well. Thank you.
And maybe maybe personalized shampoo is still going to be a thing, right? Your relentless optimism doesn't mean that idea should die, maybe.
Stay tuned.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.